Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Scott Jagow. We've all made a few financial blunders, but in life, unfortunately, there's no do-over button.
Had I known this when I was younger, I wouldn't have made the mistakes I made. And I would have a lot more going for me now than I do.
That's Kathleen Smith with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. So what money mistake does she regret? Is it A, overusing credit? Always a bad idea, but now with the credit crunch in full blast, it can be deadly. Or is the answer, she regrets not having a financial planner? It's a good idea for anyone, not just the wealthy, but you got to pick the right planner. Or could her regret be a poor investment? Two words, Ginsu knives. Only one answer is correct. Stick around to find out which one it is. That's on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. I'm taking out a personal ad for a financial advisor. Looking for someone who's trustworthy, motivated to make me money, no hidden agendas, please, and certified, not certifiable. Let's see if we can find a match. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Bigland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
I owe my philosophy on money management to Cicero. He said, nobody can give you wiser advice than yourself. Of course, the first time you lose a paycheck to the stock market, you might reconsider being your own financial advisor. There are experts out there who can help manage your investments, but be careful. Some don't know what they're doing, and others could be more concerned about their own piggy bank than yours. So how do you find the right financial advisor? Jeremy Hobson looked into it for us.
To figure out just who among us has a financial planner, I went straight to the source. You've been doing this since 1999. How many clients do you have at this point?
About 150.
Wow.
150 families.
Rita Cheng is a financial planner based in suburban Washington, D.C. She's got clients of all ages and incomes, but the majority came to her once they realized just how close to retirement they are. They want to make sure they're planning appropriately.
They have the knowledge, but they don't have the time. They need an independent, unbiased third party to be their financial motivator, to hold them accountable.
To make sure they're making the right-sized contributions to their 401k, for example, or that they're not over or underinsured. Things Cheng, who's a certified financial planner, is trained to help with.
We don't always learn the right lessons from our parents, so sometimes going to a professional might actually help us see things in a little bit different light and help us prepare ourselves for the future a little bit better.
That's Robert Wegley, who chairs the Department of Personal Financial Planning at the University of Missouri. He says about a quarter of Americans have a financial planner of some kind, and the rest should seriously consider getting one, even those starting their first job or making minimum wage.
Nobody plans to fail. They just fail to plan.
That's a line planners love to use, but Wegley says you shouldn't settle on a planner until you've talked to a number of them. You can ask around for a recommendation or go to plannersearch.org for a list of planners in your area. Most importantly, Wegley says you should make sure the planner has your best interests in mind.
Does the planner listen to you and what your goals are? And does he help devise a plan to help you reach your goals? Not his goals, but your goals.
Goals that can range from saving for your kids' college education to buying a vacation home. Most, however, just want to be sure their financial house is in order. Here's Kathleen Smith of Cary, North Carolina.
I am a single woman, divorced, and I am 1 year away from 62.
And you have a financial planner.
I do. He's fabulous.
Smith got a financial planner after moving to North Carolina and after the value of her 401k retirement fund dropped by half. She decided to take matters into her own hands, or put them into a planner's hands. She only wishes she had gotten one sooner.
Everybody has a future, and everybody needs to plan for future. Had I known this when I was younger, I wouldn't have made the mistakes I made. and I would have a lot more going for me now than I do.
With the help of her financial planner, Smith moved her retirement savings into different funds and opened a Roth IRA. She's also gotten help refinancing her mortgage and drafting a will. She did have to pay a 5% commission at first. Now, she pays her planner just $40 a year and talks to him about once a month. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
We'll have links on our website with more on how to find a financial planner, including Chris Farrell's tips.
Romance without finance is a nuisance.
You're not kidding, brother.
Please, please, baby, give me some gold.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Yes, the economy's down. Yeah, the stock market's uneasy. But that doesn't mean you have to sit on your investments and wait things out. In fact, downtime can be a good time to make some moves, as Jeremy just pointed out in his story. For example, shifting your money from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. Let's bring in Christine Folland. She's a certified financial planner for T. Rowe Price. Christine, why is that a smart move?
Well, right now, the market is down, generally speaking, and you're probably looking at a traditional IRA balance that's lower than what you saw, say, 6 months ago. So this could be a good time to consider converting some of your assets to a Roth IRA.
What is the benefit of doing that?
When you convert from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you have to pay taxes on the money that you're converting. If you have less money to pay taxes on, you're going to pay less in taxes, and that's going to be an opportunity for you that you won't have when the market goes back up.
Of course, that assumes that you have time for the market to go back up. I'm assuming this isn't for everybody.
Well, it is not necessarily for everybody, but there are a lot of pre-retirees. They say, let me pay my taxes now. Once I'm retired, I'd like to avoid as many tax payments as I can, because that's not going to be much fun.
So you're basically getting the taxes out of the way with the Roth IRA.
Exactly. Now, it's very important, Scott, that you pay the taxes from your taxable account, which might be invested in mutual funds, it might be in money market accounts. You don't want to dip into the IRA itself in order to come up with the tax money. If you do that, there won't be any advantage to you.
Is everyone eligible to do this, or are there restrictions on who can roll over from traditional to Roth?
Well, today, there are restrictions. In the year 2008 and 2009, there are restrictions that only people who have adjusted gross incomes of $100,000 or less are eligible to convert from a traditional IRA or a rollover IRA to a Roth IRA.
What's the argument for not doing this?
Well, the argument for not doing this is that a lot of people simply don't want to pay the government any taxes before they're due. And for some folks, no matter how good the deal might be, they're simply not interested.
Now, is this conversion an all or nothing proposition, or can you roll over a portion of your traditional IRA into a Roth?
No, Scott, you can convert as much or as little as you would like in any given year. As long as you're eligible, you certainly don't have to convert at all in 1 year.
What other things do you advise people to do in a down market?
Well, you know, you have to look at a down market as the silver lining. And in a down market, everything's on sale, if you think about it in those terms, and we all like sales. What you're doing is you're able to purchase shares of investments at a lower price than you would be if the market were very high right now. So you need to take advantage of that. If you are investing for the long term, it's counterintuitive. You say, oh, I think I'll wait until the market's back up again.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly what you don't want to do. You want to be buying now while the market is lower.
Christine Folland, she's a certified financial planner for T. Rowe Price. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time now for The Straight Story with our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing all right. The Consumer Price Index, also known as the CPI, came out this week. Food prices had their biggest jump in 18 years. Gas is at $4 a gallon. And the headline was, inflation pressures eased in April.
And if you take out food and energy, the outlook was even better.
That's what I mean. How can that be if we have such a big jump in food prices?
Part of it is the Consumer Price Index is trying to capture as a large basket of goods and services. But the ones that we are so aware of right now, I mean, how often do you go out and buy a computer?
Well, not very often.
But you go to the grocery store at least once a week. And every time you go in there, you go, oh, look at this bill. It's gone up.
But we're always told to look at the core rate of inflation in terms of whether or not there is a threat of inflation. That is taking out energy and food, the two things that we're most aware of. Why is that the case?
You don't want to pay attention to the core rate of inflation. What really matters is what's happening to my cost of living. I think that's the right way to look at it. But now I'm a policymaker and I'm in a position where I'm going to have to decide we have a weak economy, but do I need to raise interest rates to combat inflationary forces? So the reason why I take out these volatile food and energy prices is to see whether or not those price increases are seeping throughout the economy because businesses are saying we got to pass on these higher energy costs. So from a policymaker's point of view, the core rate of inflation is not a manipulation.
All right. So at the dinner table, people probably aren't talking about the consumer price index. They're talking about the price of bread. But the CPI does have some impact on their lives. As you just said, it helps determine policy. So where do we feel the impact?
First of all, if you're on Social Security, you're very aware of the consumer price index because your increase, Social Security payments are pegged to changes in the CPI. The second one is anyone who's working, management typically pegs their wage increases to what's going on with the consumer price index.
If you're a cynical guy, Chris, you might think that the Fed uses the core rate of inflation as sort of a deflection measure. But you say that Fed is not manipulating here. Why not?
I mean, I don't think there is a manipulation. There is a genuine attempt to try and understand, are increases in food and energy seeping into the rest of the economy? One of the things that's optimistic about the latest numbers is that it does appear that the overall rate of inflation is modulating. There's not a great deal of inflationary pressure throughout the economy. And what that says is that the Fed may win its gamble. It cut its benchmark interest rate to offset the credit crunch. And it got a lot of criticism, Scott, from people saying we were going to have virulent inflation. Turns out, I don't think we're going to get it. And therefore, the Fed isn't going to have to raise its benchmark interest rate, which, by the way, would take another hit out of everyone's pocketbook.
All right, that's The Straight Story from Chris Farrell. Talk to you a little later, Chris.
I look forward to it.
I have a hidden talent. For some reason, I can remember actors who played the tiniest parts in movies 20 years ago. I don't know why, but I'd like to know how these actors get their gigs. We'll find out shortly. Plus, the economy and your stomach.
It's the small luxuries that you kind of feel that you don't want to give up, but it's making a difference.
The rising cost of bread, just ahead on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Vigeland.
In Haiti, deadly riots over food prices.
Costco is now limiting purchases of rice and...
Winter wheat in Kansas City's up 25 cents. Corn prices...
Today, we continue to look at the world's food situation. Our series is called Food Fight. It sounds like what happens in a college cafeteria, but no one's having any fun in this battle over food. For so many, getting even the most basic food on the table has become a struggle. And what could be more basic than bread? Ashley Milne Tite begins our story inside a New York bakery.
Tomcat Bakery in Queens is humming with activity. Huge mixers fold the dough in steel vats. Pale, freshly formed loaves glide by on conveyor belts while workers sprinkle them with poppy seeds. After the bread rises, it goes into the oven. And not just any oven, as President Noel Labatt-Comes explains.
These ovens are a modernized version of a stone village oven that you'd see on hundreds of years ago. So you've got a stainless steel outside, but inside this actual, there's stone decks, and the bread, you'll see, will go directly onto the deck.
This artisanal approach to baking comes at a price. Comes's wholesale customers pay more for Tomcat's products than they would for a regular loaf. And then there's the escalating cost of flour, which has forced him to raise his prices twice in 6 months. Bennett O'Fally buys Tomcat's ciabatta bread for Peter Grill, his chain of healthy eating restaurants. He says he'd love to raise his own prices, but he's afraid the competition would eat his lunch.
You're price fighting with these people. You know, they need the business, you need the business, so they're lowering prices. More people are offering specials. We haven't offered specials since we opened. Now we're starting to offer lunch specials, you know, just to be competitive and to be able to get more people in the door.
Making matters worse, more notoriously cooking-shy Manhattanites seem to be rediscovering their stoves. They're ordering takeout from his restaurants less than usual.
I would say our sales have gone down, depending on the location, a minimum of 10, as high as 20%.
Of course, many New Yorkers can't splurge on regular takeout. Jose Cepeda works as a porter at Zaro's Bakery in Grand Central Station, though he doesn't shop there.
I'd rather go where I live at and buy a cake for 25 cents than spend $2.50 at Zaro's for a little cake.
But his neighborhood isn't immune from the effects of high flour prices either. Cepeda says he can't afford Wonder Bread anymore now that it's selling for $2.79 at his local supermarket.
I go to the 99-cent store and I buy a full loaf of bread for $1.50. It's cheaper bread, cheaper quality, but it's more to feed my kids.
New Yorkers of means are rethinking their shopping habits too. Robert Taylor is an executive recruiter. He grabs breakfast on the way to work a few times a week, usually coffee and a bagel.
And the price of even bagels has gone up quite a bit.
He says he and his wife have started buying less milk each week since those prices have jumped, and they're considering further changes to their diet.
I think if bread continues to go up as much as it has, we're going to have to be more careful about purchasing as much bread as we had in the past.
Bread is one thing, but what about those little indulgences that ease you through the day, like a mid-morning Danish or scone? In Brooklyn, mother of two, Tamar Smith, just stopped by her local bakery with baby daughter, Ariel.
I bought a chocolate roll and an iced coffee, and these two things were $3.50, which I think is expensive.
Smith works part-time for a local government official. Her husband is a social worker. Their grocery bills have shot up lately. She says she half wondered whether she should stay home this morning, but the promise of freshly baked goodies was too enticing.
It's the small luxuries that you kind of feel that you don't want to give up. So I still get these things and I get treats for my kids, but it's making a difference.
At Tomcat Bakery, Noel Labatt-Comes says it's the worst possible time to hike prices. He recognizes the accelerating cost of living is forcing everyone to tighten their belts.
I mean, we don't like to put any price increases through. It's not fun, but you reach a point where it's like, we can't bleed anymore. Otherwise, we just won't be here tomorrow.
Comes says farmers are expecting to plant more wheat this year than last. He hopes that could be a sign that the worst is over for bakers and bread lovers alike. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
You can listen to previous stories from our food series online at marketplace.org. Whether it's at the bakery or the drugstore, everybody's looking to save money. But you know what's even better? Saving money and saving time. It's always been tough to do both. Usually you pay extra for convenience. But the internet has opened up a whole new world of possibilities. Personal finance columnist Ron Lieber has tapped into a lot of those time-saving ways, but he may have just found the pinnacle of the time-money continuum.
I know way more about saving and spending than most people, but my goal is to think about my own as little as possible. So I automate. You probably automate too. Your employer direct deposits your paycheck and tosses 5 or 10% into a retirement account. Your cell phone company charges the bill to your credit card, and your credit card company yanks the full balance or the minimum payment from your bank account each month, and so on. But for me, the holy grail is to satisfy every one of my basic regular money needs without having to even think about it. So imagine my delight when I discovered that it's now possible to subscribe to my favorite toilet paper. No more late-night trips to the corner store. No more 3-hour round-trip Costco runs. We have Amazon to thank for this great leap forward. Through their Subscribe and Save program, you tell the company what kind of toilet paper you want, how much you need, and how often you want it to show up at your house. That's it. It just comes, and at a discount to what you'd pay Amazon if you were buying it only once. It's not just toilet paper, either. You can put Tide on your list or a bunch of other groceries and toiletries. And so that list of things that you don't need to worry about anymore, but you don't need a butler to do, tasks in your life that just happen without your thinking about it, that list gets longer. I love that list. My mortgage gets paid this way now, with the full amount disappearing from my bank account automatically each month on the due date. No late fees anymore, ever. So what isn't on that magic list yet? Well, nobody comes to my house to fill my car with gas. And buying $20 birthday presents for all of the random parties my daughter attends, that's pretty high up there on the list of life's annoyances. But now, thanks to my toilet paper subscription, I at least have some more time to help her pick something out.
Ron Lieber is formerly of FiLife. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Do you have a question about money that's just burning a hole in your brain? And if you don't get it resolved, it's going to drive you crazy. But we're here to set your mind at ease, because it's time for Getting Personal, where we try to answer those burning questions about personal finances. The good doctor is in. Chris Farrell, how are you?
I'm doing well, and welcome, and I'm going to try not to drive you crazy, Scott.
All right. Our first call is from Jennifer in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
So I understand that you have a daughter in college who is about to graduate.
Actually, she graduated 2 weeks ago.
She just graduated. Well, congratulations to you and her.
Thank you very much.
And I understand she's been in a sorority throughout her college years.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
She joined when she started school, and at the time, I guess she was informed ahead of time of what the fees would be, and she went in with full knowledge of what she was getting herself into. And I think her junior year, the sorority decided to build housing. Apparently, they were unable to fill all of the rooms in the housing. So the sorority informed the girls that everyone who wasn't living in the sorority would have to cover the cost of the unrented rooms. And so each girl was assessed $400. And my daughter was willing to pay it. And she spoke with her advisor and told her that she would work out a payment plan and she would pay monthly. Apparently nobody bothered to follow up on that. And now, a couple weeks before graduation, she got a notice that because she hadn't paid that fee, she was going to have her name sent to a collection agency. And all of the girls who had any unpaid fees, their names would be sent to collection agencies.
Yeah, that's, I actually was in a fraternity in college and was the president of the fraternity for a while. So I understand this from both points of view.
Uh-huh.
So what is your question for Chris?
My question is, does she really have to pay that? I mean, are they legally able to say, because you're not paying this, we can give your name to a collection agency, because she definitely doesn't want her credit ruined.
Sure. And I'm not an expert in the finances of fraternities and sororities, but two things that I do know. One is, in order to refer someone to a debt collection agency, that is supposed to be in the overall contract that comes out of national headquarters as one of the options. The second thing, and probably even more important, is to check in. Every college and university that has fraternities and sororities has an office of fraternities and sororities. And I was looking through a number of them the other day, and they have very clear and fairly rigid rules and regulations for how fees and debts are to be treated before you end up with a debt collection.
Okay.
Another question here is, you know, $400 is $400, but still, when you weigh that against the hassle you might have to go through, Chris, is it worth it just to kind of let this one go and just pay it?
Well, yes. If it were me, I'd just pay it, put it behind me, a little bit disappointed in the way it's been handled. It's a $400. I don't want to have to deal with you again. Fee.
Okay.
All right, Jennifer, thanks so much, and good luck with your situation there.
Thank you, and I will make those phone calls.
Take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, we can't promise you a degree in personal finance, but we might be able to answer your question. Let us help. You can visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. Or you can give us a call at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Our first email of the day comes from Chris in Orlando, Florida. About a year ago, Chris started an LLC, a limited liability company. And it's just like it sounds. The person who sets it up has less liability for the actions and debts of the company than a corporation. So Chris had this grand idea about an LLC in the beginning, but he hasn't really done anything with it since then. Now all the paperwork and fees are starting to get the better of him, and he wants to know what the easiest and cheapest way is to close it. Chris, what do you think?
It's very simple. You go to the Florida Department of State, and you go to all the forms that they have for incorporation and LLCs, and one of them is called dissolution. And you fill it out and you pay the various fees and then you dissolve the LLC. And every state has its own procedures, but essentially every state has its own dissolution form. And it's very simple. And again, there is a small cost associated with removing this corporation from the universe.
Is there anything else he might be worried about here? Identity theft, perhaps? Any danger of that?
You know, there's always some risk of identity theft. Most of the identity theft that's going on these days, Scott, I really think is you're doing business and it's being stolen essentially from that business. That seems to be where the really big trouble in identity theft is. So there's probably a small risk, but you are dissolving the corporation. You're doing it through the Florida Department of State. It's a legal document. So that gives you a fair amount of protection. And then, of course, I'm going to give my standard answer, which is important. You're always going to want to be checking your credit report to make sure that nobody is running up debts or buying islands in the Caribbean under your name.
All right. Thank you, Chris. If you need help getting out of a financial mess, give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link and stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in this show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This was Upfront Week in New York. That's when the networks announced their fall TV lineups. There's a long list of star names hitting the tube next season, but there are also many bit parts to be had. I've always wondered how casting directors pick these people. There seem to be a million waiters and waitresses here in L.A. hoping to get a one-liner on some sitcom. So on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we visit with the casting director of Showtime's Californication. Her job is to audition aspiring actors for their 15 seconds of fame.
All right, stand over there, slate your name and your height for the camera.
Melody Spivak, 5'5".
And just, you'll direct it all to me, the line, okay? Whenever you're ready.
Sp-
Hear any change?
That's funny. Good job, Melody. Thank you.
Bye. My name is Felicia Fasano. I'm a casting director, and I work in Los Angeles, California. Almost every casting director I know has fallen into casting. Casting is not something you go to school for. People come by it from being actors, being agents or managers. I personally came from the art department, which is a little different direction, but we all learned how to be casting directors from working for a casting director. I was an assistant for Jackie Birch for 3 years, and then I went on my own. It's been 16 years now. When an actor walks to the audition room to audition, I can't really tell if they're going to get the part till they start to read, but I can sometimes tell if they're not going to get the part, if their look is completely wrong for what we're looking for. And unfortunately, some actors just psych themselves out, and so when they come in here, there's really nothing I can do to help them. They've already lost the job on their own. I had that happen the other day with an actor, and he just said, "I'm sorry, this sucks." And I was like, "Well, you know, it's not that it sucks. It's just you're overthinking it. Just do it." I have never personally used the casting couch. I'm sure it's out there. I mean, you hear more stories of producers or directors using the casting couch. And what I like to say is, casting is not a dating service. Thank you. In episodic casting, a beginning casting director could make close to $100,000 a year. Myself and other casting directors who are more experienced and work on multiple shows, maybe doing more than one pilot and more than one series a year, could make close to $200,000 a year. The most attractive thing about this job is the actors. To be in a room and watch somebody take words on a page and breathe life into it, there's nothing like that. When I was casting Barbershop, we had people coming in to read to play a part, and one of the lead actors, Anthony Anderson, came and read with them, and the room just turned into a circus because Anthony was jumping off the top of a rafter, and it was so much fun, and everyone was just having a great time, and it because I read with the actors, I get pulled into it as well, so then all of a sudden I'm an actor, you know, and it's, so that's fun. I don't have a very big ego. It's not a power trip for me. I want everyone to do well. I don't want to have to see 3,000 people for a part. I want to see the best of, you know, the few, and then bring them in and have them get the job. I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the goal. I need them to do well. Makes my job better.
A Day in the Work Life was produced by Francesca Segre. Can you think of something you'd never want to sell? One of your favorite things in the whole world. Now, what if you had to put it on eBay or Craigslist because otherwise you couldn't pay the rent?
I had the 100-watt Marshall tube amp, which is like the most sought-after amplifier ever.
Selling treasures online to pay the bills. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Vigeland. What do you think these things have in common? A 1984 Corvette, a Marshall Stack amplifier from 1971, Nolan Ryan's 68 rookie baseball card. They're all prized possessions being sold on Craigslist. Each seller has a different story, but they share a common theme. They need money to pay the bills, like gas and food. The number of sale listings on Craigslist doubled in March compared to last year. Ron in San Diego is the one selling the guitar amp. Ron, I understand you had a whole vintage guitar and amp collection. What'd you have?
I had the 100-watt Marshall tube amp, which is like the most sought-after amplifier ever, one that like Jimi Hendrix and Clapton played. I mean, you name it, anyone who's anybody's played a Marshall Super Lead.
So how did you get to the point where you're having to sell your most prized things?
Basically, I hit a negative cash flow when the real estate market crashed about 2 years ago. I'm a residential mortgage banker.
Mm.
I've worked for banks like Washington Mutual and World Savings, but the last lender I worked for was Washington Mutual, which was for like a good 5 years. I'm used to making six-figure income without really any effort at all, to be honest with you.
Huh.
If I applied myself, I'd make a good $250,000 a year. And that's pretty much been the flow of things since, like, 1999.
So it's been good times.
Yeah, so I loaded up, you know, was able to buy every dream amplifier I ever wanted. And I, you know, started a collection. I started buying real estate as well. I bought a rental and some land.
Right, so you got land, you've got a great collection of guitars and amps. But what happened? Where did things go wrong?
Well, slowly the real estate market just started deteriorating, the mortgage meltdown, they call it. It got to the point where lenders just didn't want to lend anymore. Even when I brought loans in that met all the requirements that even their pickiness required, they still wouldn't do it.
Hmm.
You know, they starved us to the point where they eventually laid us off and closed all the offices.
And obviously this decimated your personal finances.
Oh, yeah. I was forced to live on my savings, and when you have a mortgage of $5,000 a month, and I had about $50,000 in credit cards at the time, you know, you got a lot of bills, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line is my savings deteriorated pretty quickly, you know, having no income.
Well, I know that you've been liquidating savings, 401k, stocks, things like that.
Yeah.
How far down the line did you go before you got to the guitars and amps?
Well, once everything was gone as far as just paper money like stocks, bonds, IRA, now I'm having to resort to my physical collateral, which is my possessions, really.
Now, you've been selling it mostly on Craigslist?
Yeah, on eBay. I've sold all of those amps mostly on eBay to people from Japan, France. You know, it seems like a lot of the high-end amplifiers I was selling that were like, one of them was $9,800. It was for a 1966 half stack.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to look for people outside of the U.S. for those kinds of buys.
Hmm.
Normally, it wouldn't be a problem to sell in the U.S., but it just seems like the money isn't really there in the U.S.
So are you getting a fair price for your stuff?
Oh, yeah. I refuse to let it go for below the market value.
But you're up against it financially, so how long can you do that?
I got another month before I'm forced to do something on that.
Have you sat down and thought about how quickly things have changed here? You've gone from having all this land and making six figures to having to sell a guitar just to pay the rent?
Yeah. I saw it coming 2 years ago, and there was nothing I could do about it. It's kind of like seeing the Titanic crash, you know. You see it, but there's nothing you can do about it. I've tried everything in my power to prevent this from happening. I even tried to set up another business, and that's failed. I tried to resort to my other career, which was hotel management, was what I did before I got into this. But it seems it's been a good 15 years since I've done that, and no one will really give me a chance, you know. And the funny thing is I go and I interview, and they have no respect for anyone in the mortgage business because they get so many applicants from that line of work. You know, I've lived in my car before. I'll do it again if I have to. But, you know, I'm not too concerned with anything other than just seeing, I don't know, some kind of a secure income within the next year as my hope.
Well, Ron, I wish you the best of luck, and I hope someday soon you can build up your guitar and amp collection again.
Yes, that would be nice.
We heard from a few people selling on Craigslist. One woman in St. Paul, Minnesota told me she was trying to sell almost everything she owns. She's a single mom with three kids making $7 an hour. She's had to use credit cards just to put food on the table. But now they're all maxed out. She's looking for a better job, but she can't afford to drive too far. And she's had no luck selling her things because right now people are looking for free stuff. How are you paying your bills? We'd love to hear your story. Go online at marketplace.org and click on the contact link.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thriven.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We're back with Getting Personal, and our next question comes from Daryl in Edid, Oklahoma. His question relates to timeshares. Seems that a company cold-called his house, touting the long-term value of owning a timeshare, and offered he and his wife a vacation package to attend a seminar. You know, one of those seminars. Daryl is in government service, so a forced vacation, he says, isn't the worst thing that could happen. So he and his wife went there. And no surprise, the company was really pushy and offered a very hard sell. While they didn't agree with the timeshare company's tactics, he didn't want to dismiss the concept entirely. So, Chris, are there any timeshares out there that are decent?
Well, I'm going to give my basic answer. And then every time I give this basic answer, in the weeks following, someone will come up to me and say, you know, we have been using a timeshare for the past 20 years and we're really happy with it. It does work out for some people. But, boy, I got all kinds of warning bells. First of all, I don't buy anything that comes through a cold call. I don't know about you, Scott, but that's just sort of, I put that down. Not going to deal with that. Secondly,
just gives me the creeps.
It does. Here's the big problem with timeshares. They're very easy to buy. But once you own one and you want to get rid of it, good luck. There's not much of a market for selling timeshares. Now, right now, the market is essentially dead at the moment. If you think of what's happening with housing and condos and townhomes, right, it's not surprising that the timeshare market is not doing well. But even in the best of times, to sell a timeshare, you're going to have to take a big haircut in order to get rid of it. My bottom line, I am not a timeshare fan.
I can see that.
Yes.
Okay, so say you think you might still jump in and do a timeshare despite the reservations. What should you look for?
The only times it works is if, one, you like the property. Two, it's a place you really want to keep going back to. And you want to find out if there is an exchange program, which often there is. So, example, you have your timeshare in Colorado. And, you know, you don't want to go to Colorado this summer. You'd like to go to Arizona.
Or every summer for the next 20 years.
Exactly. So I'd be doing my research there.
Okay. Good advice, Chris. Do you have a pressing financial question? Visit our website and tell us about it. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link, or you can give us a call, 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Dave from Indianapolis, Indiana, has our next email. Seems he met with a new investment broker. And at first, this broker seemed on the level, sound opinions on asset allocation and diversification. But Dave wanted to do a little more research, so he went to the SEC website to research the broker and the company. Turns out the broker seemed okay, but the company had numerous hefty fines against it. Now, Dave's no expert, but he was surprised by the extent of the penalties against this company. Chris, what does this mean? Should he be worried?
The first thing is, it's good that he researched a broker. It's good that the broker has shown up to be clean. And then I would be looking not just at the extent of the penalties, but what kind of penalties. Is there a lot of churning of customer accounts? Is there issues about just lots of faulty advice? In other words, if it's a large firm and it's doing a lot of business, it can have a lot of problems, but you can be satisfied with your own broker. If you're worried about it, you know what? Then I wouldn't do business with them. And I shift, and I'm a big fan of doing it on your own through index funds, build your own diversified portfolio, and not deal with this problem. That's one way that I avoid it. But I'd come down to what's your comfort level, how confident are you in the relationship with the broker, and it's not just the extent of penalties, but what kind of penalties are against the company.
I mean, is this a case where a lot of these companies have SEC fines against them because there are so many different rules and regulations the companies need to follow? Or is it a case where, you know, you really do need to watch out for exactly what the penalties are?
That's what I think. You might need to watch out for what the penalties are. There are a lot of businesses. They can run afoul. You always have some, you know, a few bad apples. You know, I hate that expression. But the fact of the matter is, and you hear it a lot on Wall Street, you know, it's a few bad apples. Well, the fact is, they're right. There are a few bad apples in any organization that's dealing with people's money. But if you're having systemic churning of customer accounts, a lot of promising customers one thing, I'm going to give you a diversified portfolio. This is a common one. And then all of a sudden, it turns out that everything, and this is around 1999, everything went into one high-tech stock. And there are some firms that have reputations for that. There are other firms that have a reputation for not doing that. I would really look at what are the penalties and are they the kind of penalties that would really set off all kinds of alarm bells. But I think it's good that he's done the research, and I think it's good that he's found a broker that has, according to him, and I think it's true, a clean record.
Well, Dave certainly did his homework, and that is to be applauded. Well, that's all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris Farrell is now answering your personal finance questions online every day of the week. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us, 877-275-6669, 877-ASK-MONY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
It was fun, Scott.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. They have names like Check and Go, Get Instant Green, and of course, The Money Store. In 1995, there were something like 200 payday loan stores in America. Now there are 24,000. That's more branches than Starbucks and McDonald's combined. And payday loan centers aren't even legal in some states. So quick cash websites are popping up. Business reporter Stephen Franklin wrote about this for the Chicago Tribune. Stephen, why have these loan stores exploded in the last decade?
Well, there was deregulation, banking deregulation. High interest rates led a lot of states to withdraw the usury laws. And then there were various court rulings that opened the way for interstate banking, that opened the door for companies to suddenly realize that they can do business across state lines.
Besides these stores that you see in your neighborhood, now there are these online pay loan sites. What's the difference between the two?
Well, the difference is dramatic. Basically, you write a check and say, if I don't come to pay this bill back, then you can cash my check. When you go to an online site, you do this electronically, and they have the right to go into your checking account and take the money, and you almost can't stop them. The other difference is you often don't know who the people you are, who you're dealing with. When you go into a payday loan store, you see a sign, you look at people. Problem with online is you have no idea, and oftentimes they hide.
So given that, why on earth would anyone grant a stranger who they've never met online access to their checking account?
I think the answer is people want money, and many of these payday loan sites, they look very legitimate and very decent and honest. And my suspicion is that, and the people I've talked to have said this, is that you don't have to go to a store. You can do it at home or at work. There's no embarrassment to it, and it's very fast.
I've heard about these interest rates that can be 800%, and you cite even as high as 2,000% in your story.
Right.
How do those kick in? Is it automatically, or if you don't pay within a certain amount of time?
No. The minute you borrow money, you borrow at that rate.
But if you're going online and you have a checking account with a bank, why would you need to get a loan from a payday loan site? Why couldn't you just get a credit line from your bank?
That's the core of the issue. What you tend to find is that the people who use payday loans are people who have bad cash. They have no credit reliability. And that's why studies have indicated that the bulk of people who use payday loans are working poor and low moderate income.
So the people that are doing this, do they actually know what they're getting into, a 2,000% interest loan?
There are several ways of explaining that. I've talked to folks in different groups. There are those folks who walk into a store and look at a sign, and the sign says payday loans in this state are capped at this figure, and they figure, oh, this is a payday loan. Well, they're really taking a loan that's in a different category, and they don't know what's happening. They don't realize that they're getting this high rate. There are other folks who realize that's the rate, but they have no choice. There's an illness in the family. They're going to lose a car. They can't pay a hospital bill, and they figure, whatever it is, I'll do that. And then there's a third group who just can't get out of the rut, and they're sort of addicted to having money when they need it.
So with the recession or threat of recession and the economy definitely in a downturn, are we seeing more middle-class people turning to these kinds of loans?
That seems to be the case. Not all payday loans companies are publicly held. There are a small number, and they seem to indicate that's the issue.
Overall, between the federal government and the states, how well regulated are these payday loan sites and stores?
Two big differences: where payday loan companies operate, the states have laws controlling them. Some states have absolutely no caps at all. When you're doing online, again, the situation becomes wildly different because many states don't have the ability to track who goes online. And often what people have told me is that the online companies are just too difficult for them to find. The only way they know about them are when they have complaints. The online companies often will say, we are outside the United States, and they'll use small countries like Costa Rica or Grenada, and therefore they're outside of U.S. law.
Well, payday loan stores don't have the best reputation, but obviously there's a market for this. Do these companies provide a service that is valuable?
The payday industry will tell you that they serve people who can't get money. Consumers say it is predatory and usurious to charge someone 400%, 600%, and that states should provide options. Credit unions, banks, there should be ways of helping people get through this crisis without them facing such onerous interest rates.
Stephen Franklin, business reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, work stress be gone.
It's a great distraction. It's something that helps to release your passions. It's kept me sane.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Scott Jagow. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.